It's Inauguration Day again, kind of the second Inauguration Day, but it's the one with all the pomp and ceremony. And the day we get to find out what Obama's got on his mind for term number two, from the economy to immigration. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's all things political, and we're joined by David Swerdlick. He's a contributing editor at The Root, and he's also a blogger for the New York Daily News. And it would be great to hear from you this hour. What are you expecting to hear from Obama today? And what is he thinking about the economy, gun control, and immigration? Will we be seeing a tougher Obama, more bipartisanship, or more of the same? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And David Swerdlick, welcome.
Hi, Veronica. How are you this morning?
Doing well. Happy MLK Day.
Yes, absolutely. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Good,
how about yourself?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to watching the inauguration.
Yeah. It's going to be a big day today. Not as big, I guess, as the previous inauguration 4 years ago, but it's a big day for the country. What are we expecting to see?
Well, absolutely. It's not as big. D.C. is not as jam-packed. My wife and I actually were in D.C. over the weekend. The Root had an inaugural ball, and we enjoyed that and saw the sort of pre-inaugural atmosphere. I'm not there anymore, but I can say that, you know, it's still the town is pretty packed. You know, of course, there's a lot of streets blocked off. There's kind of this, you know, festive mood in the air, but there are about half as many people coming in from out of town as last time, and I think that just is indicative of the fact that 4 years ago, I think all Americans, whether they had voted for President Obama or not, were looking at him as this historic figure. We were moving from the Bush era to the Obama era, and now we're still celebrating our republic. We're still celebrating the reelection of President Obama and commemorating it, but now people are starting to see him more as a politician, a president, an executive, and less as this sort of historic figure with question marks about what was it going to all mean and what was he going to do. And I think that's why there's still excitement, but it's tamped down a little.
Do you think that's good for Obama that, you know, some of the pixie dust is wearing off, that he gets just to be a president instead of, you know, a historic president in quotes and capital letters?
I actually do think it's good for Obama. I mean, politicians always like to have their approval ratings high, and they always like to have their popularity ratings high. But if anything, there was that characterized Obama's first term, it was this idea of extraordinarily high expectations. And I think that over time, the White House team, which did have some growing pains over his first term, kind of came to understand that it was better to under-promise and over-deliver, let's say in a case like when they finally tracked down Osama bin Laden, versus situations where they over-promised and perhaps under-delivered, like health care reform, let's say. So they've learned that lesson, and I do think that the slightly tamped-down expectations is probably going to help President Obama. He's still personally popular, even if people don't agree with all his policies, and at least for today and then a couple weeks from now for the State of the Union, he knows how to give a good speech. So right now, he's in good shape. We'll see where he is in a few weeks, though, of course.
Right, and today, I guess, he's going to talk for about 20 minutes. It's not going to be a big, beefy speech. It's not the State of the Union, and I gather he's probably going to save the real meaty content for that, but what do you think he'll be talking about today to sort of set the tone for the next 4 years?
Well, right. When he gets to the State of the Union at the beginning of February, like you said, that'll be a longer speech. That'll be a laundry list of policy prerogatives. This one will be shorter and pared down. He will probably, I think, touch on a few key things because this is his advantage, the power of the pulpit, as they say, with the presidency. You reach the whole American people at one time. But it's going to be shorter, and I think he's going to touch on the broad strokes. There's two audiences for this speech, right? All of us in the United States, okay, I've been your president for 4 years. I'll be your president for four more years. Here's where I see us going as a country. And then there's the world audience, right? This is one of those few times where the whole world is tuned in. And I personally expect him to at least briefly touch on this idea that he touched on in his first inaugural address to the Middle East, where he kind of said, look, he had the refrain of, we will extend our hand if you unclench your fist. And I think that's something that that's one thing that he definitely stayed true to throughout the course of his his first term. He wanted friendship with the Middle East, but he was going to pull back the hand of friendship if it was not returned. And I think that's a message for the world. I think he's going to look for greater cooperation with Europe on a bunch of issues. And then in terms of the domestic issues that I think he'll at least touch briefly on today, maybe gun control, although I think he might save that for future fights. And then also this idea that for the last couple of months, we've been focused on other things. Now it's time to think back on the economy, on people that are still out of work. Things are getting a little bit better, but they're not where we want them to be.
Well, and I was going to ask if the economy is still the whole enchilada, or if there's sort of enough cautious optimism about the way that's heading that we can sort of divert our attention to other things for a little while.
Well, you know, again, going back to him being how he starts off his first term and whether or not he's in good shape, some of the indicators for Obama are looking pretty good, right? The Dow closed Friday at 13,649. That's more than double where it was at the start of his first term. So I think people on Wall Street do recognize that. I think people, all of us with 401ks, we may not think about it every day, but that's directly tied into that, into everyone's savings and retirement. And then unemployment is what anyone would call unacceptable, 7.7%, I believe we ended last year on, and there are still a lot of people who have dropped out of the labor market, but 7.7 from a high of 10 in 2009 at one point, it's Obama's, that's his sort of, again, it's not perfection. It doesn't mean he's been completely successful, but I think it starts him off on a good foot with the numbers. Housing starts are recently up. Consumer confidence has stayed kind of flat. So he has something to build on, and I think people will be listening today saying, okay, yes, you do have something to build on. What are you going to do to actually build on it and get us back to what we, the American people, consider our robust economy, consider prosperity? I don't think people and that's the president's job. I think the job of the people is to realize is that where we are in our time as a country, right, the idea of getting 7 or 8% growth like China is just off the table right now, right? We want to get back from 2% growth to maybe 3.5% growth. But we're not going to grow like China, India, Brazil, because we are a developed economy. We're a mature economy. And that's something that might happen in the far future, but it's not going to happen in the next 4 years.
Well, and part of that is when Obama went into office, there was great hope that he was going to be a centrist figure that could work with Democrats and Republicans, that he could bring people together. You know, he had his whole no red state, blue state, you know, one country thing, which seemed like it was going to extend to the political parties. It really didn't. It was a bloody 4 years. Is anything going to be different as we go into this term? I think we've seen a few indications that he's going to be a little bit tougher, but what are you seeing?
Well, let me answer that in two parts, Veronica, and let me say that, you know, the couple of other times that I've come on and talked with Kathleen, we actually have talked about this exact point, so you're right, you're hitting the nail on the head there, and I would say this, in terms of him being a centrist, this is how I see it. I actually think Obama is very much a centrist. He's certainly not what you would describe at this point as a far-left progressive. He's either a conservative Democrat. He's governed either as a conservative Democrat or, in my view, I've said in the past, he's governed in some ways like a liberal Republican. I mean, right, there's nothing Obama's done in 4 years that wouldn't have been done by the first President Bush, by President Ford, President Nixon, President Eisenhower, Teddy Roosevelt. It's Obama is right in line with that middle-of-the-road governing of past executives. I think where the modern conservative movement has gone more conservative, and they've gone from with Reagan, or say starting back with the roots of Barry Goldwater and going into the Reagan and post-Reagan era, modern republicanism has gone more to the right, and so Obama's still there in the middle. It's just that the opposition party, in my view, is further to the right. So I do think he's been centrist, but I understand your question. You're kind of saying, look, he was supposed to bring people, to put his arms around people on both sides of the aisle and bring them together, and that clearly didn't happen. And I do think, though, that what folks have to understand is that Obama, in my view, did try to do that, let's say, in the first 2 years of his presidency, right? He kept Guantanamo open. He used Mitt Romney's health care plan. He drew down in Iraq and ramped up in Afghanistan, which was a campaign promise of his. He voted, his last meaningful vote as a senator was to vote for TARP, for the banks. But toward the end of his first term, rather, it became clear, I think, to Obama and his team that moving that many steps closer to the Republicans wasn't getting them where they wanted to go. So after they got past the 2011 debt ceiling fight, and after they got past the extension of the payroll tax, which is no longer extended, everyone, your listeners have probably noticed it in their paychecks these first couple of weeks of 2013. After he got past those fights, he went more partisan for the 2012 campaign, and he's doing it now. We've already seen with the gun control, gun safety debate. He's taking a harder line with Republicans in Congress because I think they've learned a lesson that trying to move two steps toward the Republicans first wasn't as effective as they wanted it to be.
It's funny because that approach kind of worked for Bill Clinton, didn't it? He was known as the great triangulator. He would just pick that third point in the middle, which drove some people crazy. And you're sort of saying that Obama was doing a bit of that and is doing a bit of that, but maybe it just wasn't working out as well. What changed?
Well, a couple things have changed. And I think the one clear thing that's changed is the Tea Party. But let's talk about Bill Clinton for a minute, right? I mean, Bill Clinton in the rearview mirror is fascinating. He's arguably the most popular politician alive in the United States today, if not the world. He's I would say, the most gifted political speaker. But we tend to now think of Clinton as this hero from the left. But remember, Clinton put in place the don't ask, don't tell policy that Obama later repealed. Clinton was mired down in Somalia, a much smaller conflict than Afghanistan. Clinton did a welfare reform proposal that was very unpopular with liberals at the time, although in my view wound up being good policy. So it's different to look at Clinton in the rearview mirror, and I think he's a centrist figure as well. He was better than Obama. I think if there's one criticism I would level at Obama is Clinton and many of Obama's predecessors were better at the behind-the-scenes sort of personal relationship building, and this is not something that, you know, this is pretty much the received wisdom now. I don't think this is new to your listeners, that Obama is sort of a tightly wound guy. He's cool and collected on the outside, but a little introspective, a little professorial, not the backslapper, glad hander. He doesn't live to politic like Bill Clinton does, and that has been costly for him in some of these legislative battles, no question, no question. Mm. The other part of I meant to go back to the Tea Party, Veronica, I think that is the other thing. We've seen this progression I mentioned before from the Barry Goldwater era to the Reagan era and now to the Tea Party era. The Tea Party coincided with Obama. Part of it was a reaction to Obama, and this has taken the, if you will, the base or the core, the hardest of the hardcore of the conservative movement in an even further rightward direction, where it's not just a thing where they want to cut deals with Obama like past Republican leaders did, but they really want to draw a line in the sand and thwart Obama. And in my view, it's not productive for the country. But I think, in fairness to them, they see it as that's what at least the Tea Party members of Congress, they see it as that's what they're there for. So I think people, even though most Americans, I think it's fair to say, want to see compromise, want to see comedy on Capitol Hill, they want the government to just come up with what a lot of people would consider common sense solutions, there are ideological fights being had. They're not fighting over nothing all the time. And that's been part of it, too. And that's the part that's more about Obama's opposition.
Well, I'm not sure where people's opinions are in terms of what they think about the government right now. They were pretty low, especially this past year. Obama, I think he's like you said, he's looking a little bit better. There was some CNN polling this morning that showed that 54% of Americans think he will be an outstanding president. That's pretty decent marks going in.
Oh, definitely, definitely. No, and that midway through an 8-year presidency, I think that's all that anybody, including President Obama, could ask for. He's still riding a wave, though, from the November election, from having a re-election that was more convincing than many thought. Many folks, including myself, after the first debate, don't want to go back to that too much, but after the first debate where Romney seemed to get the better of him in that first debate, I think it did look for a moment there like, maybe Mitt Romney can win this election. But then in the bump that Romney got sort of faded toward Election Day. And by the end, Obama was not – didn't win in a – he didn't win a popular vote landslide, but it was an electoral vote landslide, and the electoral votes are what counts ultimately. So in terms of where he's starting out, once we get past today and get past the State of the Union and get into some of these issues like that you mentioned in your open about gun control, about immigration, about the ongoing and ever-present budget debates, whether he really starts to ratchet down in Afghanistan, things will become more contentious. He will probably fall back down closer to the 50% mark in terms of popularity and job approval. That would be my guess.
Well, we're talking politics this hour, all things political, with our guest David Swerdlick. He's a contributing editor at The Root and a blogger for the New York Daily News. I'm Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn, and we're hoping to hear from you this hour about what you're expecting from Obama in the next 4 years and from the two parties, Democrats and Republicans, as they move forward into this next 4 years as well. Tell us what you're thinking about and what issues you think are going to be on the table and how you think they're going to go down. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. Veronica Rickert with you in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you today. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we talk all things political, and of course, we're talking Inauguration Day this hour, and getting your thoughts on the topic with our guest, David Swerdlick, a contributing editor at The Root, also a blogger for the New York Daily News. And we'll head to the phones now and take our first call from Ernesto in Milwaukee. Hi, Ernesto.
Hello, good morning. Happy MLK Day.
You too.
I just wanted to say how I'm really proud of my country today because we reelected this guy who was thought to be a one-hit wonder, and he's not. And it's much deeper than that. And I think the thing historically that's going to be noticed is that this is the end of Reaganism. It's the end of the the beginning of a belief in the federal government again. And I think very subtly that the Hurricane Sandy did this for us, that just before Election Day, we get hit by this hurricane, and with Katrina fresh in mind, the federal government did a good job, and the president did a good job of it. And so it put to flight all these Republican proposals to make FEMA a state-run organization, and I think that's a big historical thing that's going to be seen. But other than that, I'm glad to be an American today. I'm really proud of my country.
All right. Well, thanks for the thoughts, Ernesto. And Ernesto flying high going into this inauguration day. I'm guessing from some of the numbers that he's not alone. What do you think,
no,
David?
Definitely. I think Ernesto brought up two really good points. One is that there is a certain significance that's different now but equally important from 2009, where at that time, as I mentioned a little earlier, you know, we as a country were looking at President Obama as this historic figure. He still is, of course. But Ernesto pointed out that there was a little bit of a feeling, too, like, okay, maybe this guy might be a one-hit wonder. Maybe it's all about him being the first black president. And as it turns out, I think a lot of people are proud of the fact that, hey, we reelected Obama. We recognize that he did a good job, not a great job all the time, but that now he can start to be viewed less as this historic figure and more as just his president with his place among the presidents. And Ernesto brought up MLK Day as well. And one really important point I wanted to make sure that I made here was that because President Obama came in as an African American first and as the first black president, you know, he has been compared to other black leaders, other black historical figures, particularly MLK. And I think what we've found as a country over the last 4 years is that there's a pride that Americans have taken, not everybody, but many people, not just black people, but all people who admire President Obama, black, white, Asian American, Latino, Native American, are taking pride in their president, whether they agree with him on every policy, but also starting to see that he's not an MLK, that the president has really now more in common 4 years in with George Bush and with George Washington than he does with MLK. He's a president. He's part of the President Club, not the Civil Rights Club, not the historic, you know, club of the Martin Luther Kings and the Cesar Chavez's of the world. He's in the club with George Washington and with Eisenhower and everybody else. And that's what we've kind of come to learn between then and now. The other thing I think that Ernesto brought up was a great point was I would disagree slightly with Ernesto that the era of Reagan is going away, because I think there are a lot of people who still believe passionately in what Ronald Reagan was about movement conservatism. I do think, though, that we're going to find out in the next 4 years, as Ernesto pointed out, that we're going to decide whether we believe as a country in what the federal government does for people. For instance, when we get to the March fight over the budget again, now that Republicans are slowly backing away from the debt ceiling, it's going to be more like, I think, the 94 government shutdown, Gingrich versus Clinton. And the idea there wasn't about the debt ceiling. It wasn't about these obscure sort of accounting issues that the Treasury Department goes through that we've all just all of a sudden learned about in the last year and a half. No, it's going to be about the basic, how much does the government take in and how much does the government spend, and what are we spending the money on? And I think that Republicans have an opportunity to make a serious case if they are a little more focused on what their message is. And likewise, the president has an opportunity to make his case. Look, Americans, we have these things that we as Americans hold dear: Social Security, Medicare. Some people hold Head Start dear. Some people hold the military dear. Whatever it is, they all cost money, and money comes from taxation. And we're going to have that debate continue throughout his term. So I think those are really excellent points.
Yeah, thank you for the call, Ernesto. And it'll be interesting to see in the next 4 years what it will be like now that it sounds like President Obama has gotten away from that wax figurine that we made of him early on, and he doesn't have that albatross to carry around anymore. He can just be a president.
Exactly. Exactly. No, and I think that's an important point. You know, just to reiterate, you know, we're going to see a mature president, and a president who now we're sort of comfortable with and recognize in our homes and living rooms on TV. And so and without the prospect of a reelection campaign now that he's in his final term, it's going to be interesting to see how people sort of bond with the president or not bond with the president, as you know, because now we're on the downslope of his administration.
All right. Well, thank you, Ernesto. And moving next to Willem from Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Happy Martin Luther
morning.
King Day.
You too.
Something caught my attention in the paper about this plan that the Republicans are trying to come together with changing the Electoral College system from, you know, winner-take-all to instead of making it hinge on a congressional proportional, you know, things in the state like that. And then there are many states that are considering this, the states that have, you know, total control by one party, like Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Florida, and North Carolina, are considering this change because they've lost the last two elections, and they see this as a way for maybe the Republicans to once again hold the White House. And in our state, in the state of Wisconsin, the reproportioning was done in, you know, in secret. They all signed a secret pact to not reveal what they were doing, and then that really has rigged our state elections. But on the national elections, Tammy Baldwin won and Obama won in Wisconsin. So they see this as a problem, and this is an opportunity to change that. And as far as calling them conservatives, I think that's really a misnomer. I would say they are more like radical right-wing than conservative, and I don't think we've had a president in this country that I would consider progressive since maybe Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and War on Poverty. So, and just to see the vitriol and the hatred for President Obama on right-wing radio, people like Rush Limbaugh and all these other propagandists, it really makes you wonder, what kind of country do they want this to be? You know, I find it personally rather scary.
All right. Well, thank you for the thoughts, Willem, and appreciate it. David, what do you think?
Yeah, no, also excellent points. Let me say first, I think Willem made an interesting point about the Rush Limbaughs of the world. I would actually say that I suspect that it's better for business for the right-wing pundit class that President Obama was reelected. If Romney had won the election, I suspect that he would have done many things very similarly to Obama, and then the right-wing pundit class probably would not have had as much opportunity to criticize because they had sort of begrudgingly backed Romney. Romney is a Northeastern moderate at heart, even if he portrayed himself more conservative when he ran for president. Obama is probably more of a moderate at heart than many people thought at first, as we discussed. So it's better for the business of the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys of the world, I think, that President Obama is still in office, quite frankly, even though there will be much consternation and much complaining. To the bigger point, Willem, I'm really glad, and Veronica, if you let me dig into this for just one second, the point about the Electoral College, I think, is a really interesting, just starting to come to light. I just happened to catch wind of it on the Rachel Maddow show a few days ago, this idea that that states where the Republicans control the legislature and the governor's mansion are thinking about making a coordinated push, as Willem said, to change the rules of the Electoral College so that the number of electoral votes cast per state matches the distribution Republican-Democrat of who's controlling the House seats in that state. And as your listeners, I'm sure, know, right now each state has the same number of electoral votes as it has congressional districts. But as your listeners also know, except for Maine and I think it's South Dakota, those states are winner-take-all, right? So you don't proportionally take the results of the election and then calculate the Electoral College votes that way. If someone wins the popular vote in a state by one vote, they get all the electoral states for that vote. So the presidential election is essentially 50 statewide elections for president. Well, Democrats had a tremendous amount of success with Obama at the top of the ticket, winning back the White House. And even though they didn't gain win back the House, they gained seats in the House. They also got more of the popular vote nationwide for House seats and beat expectations by hanging on to the Senate with a bigger margin. But at the state level, right, Republicans continue to make advances in gaining state legislature control and gaining governorships. And so they control the redistricting and they control this issue that Willem brought up. And I'm going to just give you my opinion here and say the system is the system that we have, and it's not perfect. But if we're going to go ahead and start tinkering with the Electoral College, my opinion would be then just do away with it altogether. Don't start trying to tweak it. Don't start trying to, you know, twist it and manipulate it for partisan advantage just because that's all that Republicans sort of have to hold on to at a national level right now. If you're going to tinker with it at all, let's get rid of it. We've got a national election for president every 4 years. It's only contested in states like Ohio and Wisconsin and Florida, states like California and New York and Texas. The biggest states and many other states don't get a lot of attention because they're not considered swing states. If you want to have a real national election, then have a national election. And the final point I would make on that, Veronica, would be this. You know, my conception of what conservatism is, is that it's about, you know, having a set of principles and adhering to those principles and adhering to them in a conservative, not just conservative ideology, but a conservative way of doing business, right? And it strikes me as fundamentally unconservative to lose a couple of elections and then be sort of a spoilsport and say, hey, let's change the rules. Win by the rules that are in place. And I think this is a message that Republicans are even starting to hear from their own Charles Krauthammer, probably after George Will, the most important conservative columnist in the country, just wrote this last Friday. He said, look, Republicans, stop trying to come up with gimmicks to get leverage on Obama. If you want to have leverage, win an election. And I think that's the thing. And that's about messaging. It's about candidates. It's about credibility. It's not about tinkering with the rules. It's not about suppressing the vote or you know, tweaking the Electoral College.
So if you tweak the Electoral College and you say you want to get rid of it, what do you plug in instead?
Well, okay, now we're just off on my personal pet theory here, but absolutely. No, the states run the elections, and within the states, counties run the elections. But surely in our technologically advanced age, we can come up with a way every 4 years to tabulate the popular vote and just have the popular vote be the be the way that we elect our president. The vote in the state, the statewide vote, would still be voting for the statewide offices, the two senators or governor, and then the district-by-district vote would still be the way to vote for the congressional offices. You would have to normalize some election laws across states and across counties, but I think we can do that. I mean, there was a time, as your listeners know, when U.S. senators were not selected by popular vote of the people, right? They were voted on by the state legislators, and they changed that, and we all survived. I'm not actually an advocate for getting rid of the Electoral College. I'm saying that once you, crack the seal on it and start getting under the hood and tinkering with it, I say then that means it's time to get rid of it. If it stays the way it stays, so that's fine by me. Like I said, we should have enough confidence in our politicians that they're not guys who are working the refs and working the rules. There are rules in place. Some are great. Some are not so great. Politicians need to figure out a way to win within the framework of the rules because, quite frankly, if you have a good message, if you have a good candidate, and if voters have confidence in you, and you, of course, there's money in there too, and you have somewhat of an ability to fundraise, you're going to most times win the election. So that'd be where I come down on that.
Yeah, there's a lot of people on both sides who are unhappy with the way the vote is tabulated right now, but maybe that's a topic for another show. We'll just leave that for now.
Definitely.
And head back to the phones. Let's go to Jim, who's joining us from Sheboygan. Hey, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
Just a quick sidebar. The Democrats talked about changing the Electoral College when Bush was elected. It just depends on if you're buttering your toast on the top or the bottom after an election. So let's not call this, you know, some sort of Rachel Maddow revelation. But anyway, I know there's euphoria regarding President Obama, particularly on the left and left-wing media, like NPR, like CNN, all this kind of stuff. And for this is Inauguration Day. Actually, the last couple of days have been, apparently. But I am in a position of I detest virtually every policy President Obama stands for. I detest what he's done to my business and what he continues to do to my business. I detest virtually everything he stands for and his minions that follow him in lockstep. However, what I am celebrating today, and I think this should be the thrust of these types of programs, is the peaceful transition, or in this case, retransition of government that is unique to America. As we see what goes on in countries all over the world with taking up of arms, with violence, with murder, etc. In this country, we can have the visceral differences and the personal differences, such as myself. And yet, on a day like this, we transition government peacefully and move forward. And that is the unique American story, not that we elected a first black president, brown president, green president. That is not the basis of what we're doing today. We're celebrating America as a unique experiment that transitions government in a way that every other country in this world, virtually, is jealous of. And we're a horrible, rotten system. It is an awful political system, but it's the best the world's ever come up with. And that's what I'm celebrating today, not an individual. I'm celebrating this country.
Well, that was well said, Jim. Thank you so much for calling up with that. And he's right. This is a day to celebrate democracy and for a day at least to clap each other on the back and say, job well done. You know, we're doing it.
Oh, absolutely. No, Veronica, I think Jim probably made the most important point of all, which is that, as he so eloquently said, we are celebrating not primarily the individual, and maybe I, mischaracterized it a little earlier, but we're celebrating the peaceful transfer of power, even though in this case it's a peaceful transfer from Barack Obama's first term to his second term, but that for all its imperfections, we have the best system in the world, the most enduring system in the world, and that the beauty of our system, in a roundabout way, as Jim said, is that even if you are unhappy with the President Barack Obama's policies or his presidency, you know from today that 4 years from now, it will be someone else who's being inaugurated. And that is the beauty of our system. I do want to just say, though, to Jim, that I think he's absolutely right that we should strive not to look at the president as the black president or to celebrate people, reflexively for being the first black president or the first black anything or the first woman of anything or anything of anything. That being said, I do think it's important to recognize that for African Americans, this is a point of pride that coming from where African Americans have come from, an African American has come to lead the nation. It doesn't go past that. He still has to govern and make decisions, but it is a tremendous sense of pride, and I don't think that should be overlooked. I also think it's a sense of pride for Americans who aren't African American, and I'm going to include Jim in this, I'm sure, is that we have come so far as a society where something that once seemed not possible, not plausible, is now in fact a reality. And I think it's that and past today. It's not the primary issue, but I do think it's worth celebrating. Last point on Jim, if I may, Veronica, mm-hmm. would just simply be he mentioned that he didn't like the way President Obama's policies. I don't know if he's still on the line. Okay, I was going to say that I do understand from the perspective of many small business people, or maybe Jim has a large business, that President Obama's Affordable Care Act, or the Affordable Care Act that he came up with Congress, has put a burden on businesses. I wish he was still on the line, because I would ask him what other policies did he feel were hurting business. Because, again, you look at the stock market, you look at housing starts, you look at employment. 4 years ago, we were 3 months out from the Lehman Brothers collapse. Things were really in doubt, and I do think that the Obama administration deserves some measure of credit, if not for transforming and completely getting us into high gear, keeping the bottom from falling out on our free market system. So that would be my question. Other than healthcare, what are the other issues that are objectionable? That's all. But that, again, probably a topic for another time.
Right. And thanks for those thoughts, David. And I keep thinking about how cool it is that today he gets to use two Bibles, a Bible that Lincoln used to swear in on, and MLK Jr. How amazing must that feel?
Oh yeah, no. I mean, it's very momentous for the country. It brings us back to our history, our roots. I think it's kind of interesting that President Obama will wind up today taking the oath of office for the fourth time. Remember, he had the do-over in 2009, and then this time he took the official oath on the official inauguration day yesterday and the ceremonial oath today. So four times he and Chief Justice John Roberts have done the oath. I think it's not to dip a toe back into what we were talking about before about celebrating first, but I do think it's something to celebrate that the vice president will be sworn in by the first Latina Supreme Court justice. That should be a point of pride for everybody as well. And Obama has framed a lot of his image in this Lincoln legacy. I actually tend to compare him to probably other presidents. I think he's a little more like more recent presidents, like an Eisenhower or a Ford, or a Nixon. But he likes Lincoln. He's from Illinois. Lincoln's from Illinois. So I think it's just reinforcing that message that Obama wants to come across as a someone who admires Lincoln's presidency. And I think that's great.
Yeah. Has anyone ever sworn in on the Lincoln Bible? I mean, not the Lincoln, the Nixon Bible.
I suppose not. Curious. And I'm speaking ideologically.
Right.
Obviously,
I know.
I also would say that in a sense, Obama brings a little bit of everyone. He brings a little bit of Bill Clinton, probably not Bill Clinton's flair for the political, but he brings a little bit of the first President Bush. He brings a little bit of a Lyndon Johnson. He brings a little bit of a George Washington. You know, these presidents build upon each other. It's the most elite club in the world, and they build upon each other. I think that's why you saw, Clinton and Nixon develop a friendship later in Clinton's presidency. I think that's why you see you know, President Obama and President the first President Bush have this sort of amicable relationship. You know, people those are the only people that have been through what they've been through, and so they look back on these other presidents. But you're right. No, you would probably not see. You'd probably more sooner see someone swear in on Lincoln's Bible than anybody from the last century, let's say. Yeah.
Well, we're talking all things political this hour and Inauguration Day, of course, with our guest David Swerdlick, who's a contributing editor at The Root. He's also a blogger for the New York Daily News. And we're taking your phone calls, your emails. You're sharing your thoughts with us this hour as we think about what to expect going forward and maybe about some of the issues that are lying in wait out there, from the economy to immigration reform to gun control. What are you expecting to see, and what are you expecting out of today? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is the bicentenary of Jane Austen's book Pride and Prejudice, and coming up after 10 o'clock, I hope you'll stay with us as we speak with a Jane Austen biographer about all things Jane. This hour, it's All Things Political. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn this week, as we speak with David Swerdlick this hour, a contributing editor at The Root and a blogger for the New York Daily News. We're talking about the inauguration and what to expect in the next 4 years, the second term of Barack Obama. And back to our phone lines we go. Dave is joining us from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. I think we have to look back and first learn about what happened in the past 4 years to try to shape, and it's our responsibility to hold these politicians accountable. In the last 4 years, we saw the government not shut down. I'm glad your guest brought up the shutdown under Clinton. The Republicans learned under that, so they tweaked it, and they didn't shut it down. Now, they just slowed everything down so that nothing gets done. Record number of filibusters, nearly 400, equivalent to 70 years previous to that. And they decided nothing is going to happen under a Democrat. And it doesn't matter if this man is black or green. He's a Democrat, and they will not allow Democratic policies to go into place. They do not respect the vote. That's why they gerrymandered to keep the House. The only reason Republicans have the House is because of gerrymandering. Democrats outvoted them by 1 million votes in the House. I mean, popular vote, we should have all three houses. And what their strategy is to just slow everything down, not let anything happen, including growth. We were told this guy's going to destroy our economy. So the policies and the things that they do in Congress to stop anything from happening is real clear. And we see that from the past 4 years. And the last caller, you know, rotten political system, he's absolutely right. But only when the system is undermined, when it's abused, the filibuster abuse, it really did undermine our system. And our system becomes rotten when it becomes undermined and abused. And so these next 4 years, it's important for us to hold the people who are the abusers accountable, and to really push and to let everybody know this is what they're doing, because for 4 years we did not hear about all of the filibusters. And I wanted to get your guests' thoughts on that.
All right. Thanks, Dave. David?
Oh, yeah. No, Veronica, all your callers are spot on, and I think Dave made a really good point about the filibuster and the abuse of the filibuster, and I would agree with him that Republicans in Congress, Republicans in the Senate specifically, probably abused the filibuster during President Obama's first term. And even though there's no filibuster in the House of Representatives, I do think that there was a level of intransigence among the House majority in the House of Representatives. That was also sort of an abuse of power. I do think, though, that Democrats played a role and share some of the blame, not for abuse, but for what I would say is being afraid to lose votes. In other words, if you go back to, let's say, the public option debate in healthcare, now Obama had this clear idea. He's gonna reach out to Republicans and say, oh, okay, you don't want healthcare reform? Let's use Mitt Romney's healthcare reform plan. All right, and it still barely passed with 60 votes in the Senate, just enough to break a filibuster. But, you know, progressives were disappointed that there was no public option or no Medicare for all, but part of that was because they weren't willing to put something up for a vote that might lose. My thought would be sometimes you have to put a vote up knowing that there's a possibility that it might lose just to prove a point. Here's an example, the current gun control debate that we have post-Newtown. This is an issue where people have clearly formed opinions on one side or the other of the aisle. This is not like healthcare where the average person or even the average journalist is looking at it going, bending the cost curve, what does that mean? I don't understand premiums. How is moving $716 from this pot in Medicare over to Medicaid going to help the economy? When you're talking about gun control, most people have a pretty good gut feeling about where they want to see it go or what they want to see happen. So I think it would behoove the congressional Democrats who are driving this and the president and the vice president to just craft their law, figure out what they think can pass, maybe do a little politicking on the Hill, and then the Senate, since Democrats control the Senate, just has to put it up to a vote and essentially dare Republicans not to vote for it. And then, because then, if the people are dissatisfied, then the onus will be on them. But the onus is not on them if it just looks like gridlock and the Democrats are afraid of a filibuster. Does that kind of following what I'm saying, Veronica? Yeah, so I think that... Dave brings up a good point about that. The system is not broken, but it is being sort of strained in the way that Dave described it, no question.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call, Dave. And to Keith in Wausau. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Interesting conversations. My question is relative to the Senate and their lack of leadership. And certainly there's Republicans are probably abusing the filibuster. But, you know, we had the president submit a budget last spring that even his own party would not support. The only one who was willing to stick his neck out was Congressman Ryan, who had a budget that actually was blasted for a big cut, but it still actually increased spending by 2 or 3% a year. But the Senate has failed to even put forth a budget in 3 years, and it seems as though the media is unwilling to call him to task for that. It's kind of hard to have a meaningful budget when no one will put something forth that can be vetted and discussed and come up with bipartisan support.
Right.
I'd like to hear your response.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Keith. David?
Yeah, no, I think that, Veronica, I think that your caller is making a great point. I think that, yes, and as I was just saying, the House Republicans, at least they did put forth a plan and articulate what they wanted to do on Medicare, specifically the Ryan plan. And because Congressman Ryan is from Wisconsin, I know your listeners are familiar with him and his politics. But in spite of that, though, I would say this, though. There's a certain... level of criticism of Senate Democrats for not having passed a budget in 3 years, but I would also suggest that the House Republicans aren't doing much better if they go around passing budgets that they know are non-starters in the Senate that will get vetoed by the president, and they're just doing it essentially to, in some cases, put a finger in president's eye or in the Senate majority's eye. I'm not saying that was Congressman Ryan's intent, but when it happens repeatedly over time, I do think it comes across that way to people, and I do think that's what wound up hurting Republicans on the national level in elections. In other words, yes, the Senate has at least passed something out of the Senate, but it's the Senate budget, the Ryan plan, is no more of a law than a thought that the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has sitting in his office, right? It's only a law if you get it through both houses and it's signed by the president. I will say this, though, about what Congress is facing in terms of working together. I mean, they've got to really get serious in the next couple of months, because I don't think either party at this point is prepared to see a slip back in the economy. It's going to hurt both Democrats and Republicans. If I think people now expect slow growth, they expect stagnation, but people don't expect us to go backwards anymore. So there is some pressure built in, I think, from people on both sides of the aisle for them to get something done, even if it's not what everyone wants.
And we've got to leave it there. We're out of time, but I hope you have a wonderful day and enjoy yourself today, David.
Thank you. Enjoyed it, Veronica.
Thanks so much for being with us. David Swerdlick, a contributing editor at The Root. He's also a blogger for the New York Daily News. I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and Rob Ferret for taking your phone calls as well. And remember, there is more coverage of the Martin Luther King Jr. celebration today, 12 noon. You can hear it right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network.